Hi, this is Rainy Yang, the cinematographer of The Fire Inside. This is the cinematography podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey, Ilya, how the hell are you?
Hey, Ben, I'm doing just fine. How about you?
Good, good. You're in New York City.
I'm in New York City, and for those who want to like zoom in, which is probably no one, that back there is the Chrysler Building. You can just barely see the tip of it out the hotel window.
So, very good, yeah. Very good.
So, Ben, who is on the show today?
We have the amazing Rita Yang. It's her first time on the show. She shot The Fire Inside for Oscar-nominated cinematographer Rachel Morrison on her feature directing debut.
Has she really never been on the show before? I really thought she
Rina,
had.
I don't believe, has been on the show.
Oh, maybe not. Well, hey, this is great. I'm glad
Rachel has been on the show. We interviewed
Rachel's been on the show for sure.
We interviewed Rachel. We actually interviewed her in her house like 2 weeks before she became the first woman ever nominated for Best Cinematography, which to me is one of the great shames of the Academy and the category that that our entire podcast is based around, is that it wasn't until 2017 that a woman was nominated for Best Cinematography. And it's not like women weren't shooting for the first 100 years of cinema.
Indeed. And, well, we'll see what happens this year. They haven't announced the nominations yet for this year's Oscars, but there's some people in the running. So maybe
A couple who I think we might've interviewed who I think maybe have a chance of a nominee and or.
Don't
win.
Jinx it, but yes, exactly.
I'm not jinxing anyone. But anyway, Rachel has pivoted to directing. I don't know if she still shoots. She probably does. But she her first feature as director is The Fire Inside, which is an amazing boxing film. And it's if you haven't gotten a chance to see it, I saw it at a screening. It was probably about a month and a half ago, and it looks great. It's got amazing performances. It's kind of a two-hander, and the two leads are amazing. Like I it's like a masterclass in acting. Both the leads are great. I think Rachel's direction is great, and I think Rina's cinematography is awesome. It's always cool to talk to DPs who are shooting for other DPs when they take the director's seat to find out, like, does as an accomplished DP moving into directing, do they get into the DP's bag of tricks too much or whatever? And I think Rina puts that one to bed pretty quickly, and it sounds like they had an amazing collaboration. So I would encourage anyone to go check that movie out if they can see it. And Rina is someone definitely to watch.
And now, Close Focus.
Awesome. All right. So Ben, it's time for our Close Focus. It's the time when we talk about what sort of topical industry news events, things are going on. What do we have to talk about this week?
Well, I feel like we would be remiss to not talk about David Lynch.
Who? I've never heard of this person.
David Lynch, you know,
purveyor of coffee, right? Wasn't that his? He was mostly known for coffee.
Coffee and pie.
Yes.
Yeah. Just one of the most noteworthy directors of the last 50 years, I would say. I wouldn't say that I loved every single thing he did. But I appreciated everything that he did. And I don't think that there are a handful of directors who I feel like you could watch 15 seconds of their film and be like, oh, that's David Fincher. Oh, that's Steven Spielberg. Oh, that's Alfred Hitchcock. And Lynch to me is one of the ones who you can spot him immediately. He just has a style that nobody else has. He's worked with some amazing DPs. I've often wanted to get Peter Deming on here. I love his work with Peter Deming. He did, you know, obviously Twin Peaks, Blue Velvet, which are, also deceased friend Dan Neese, shot the Steadicam for. And that was, I think, one of my favorite things to talk to Dan about when we had him on the show the first time, was the Steadicam for Blue Velvet and the Steadicam for the opening sequence of Scream. Blue Velvet, Dune, Eraserhead. I feel like, and I was kind of talking to someone about this the other day, I feel like David Lynch gave filmmakers a permission structure for not basing all of their creative choices in realism. And I remember in my senior thesis film in college, I had seen Eraserhead and I had seen Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me right around that time. And I directly stole some of his sound design ideas and put them into my film. And they were impressionistic sound ideas, like sounds that wouldn't be in a location that literally no one will ever complain about. Like the audience is not really even aware of them, but they definitely create a vibe. And, Blue Velvet, Lost Highway, Twin Peaks. I feel like he revolutionized TV. I feel like without David Lynch, you don't. I'm not going to say HBO got the idea to do the kind of television that they started doing in the 90s from Twin Peaks, but I feel like Twin Peaks gave everyone the idea that television could be more than, I don't know, the A-Team or Dallas or
Dukes of Hazzard,
Dynasty, the kind of stuff that was going on television. The television could be art. And I guess that's, you know, even like I wasn't a big fan of his movie Inland Empire, but you look at it and you're like, it's art, man. I mean, like you can make an argument that not all film is art, but I do feel like David Lynch approached everything like an artist. I've known actors who've worked for him. Not every one of them, every single one of them says he was the biggest pleasure ever to work with. He made Eraserhead on his own dime, and that got him discovered by Mel Brooks, who hired him to make The Elephant Man, which put him almost immediately in the stratosphere as far as directors go. And then he was offered Return of the Jedi and Dune. I would pay anything to see his Return of the Jedi. but he took Dune because he didn't want to make a sequel. Dune, not the most respected of the adaptations. And he himself often said that he didn't have Final Cut and it ruined it for him and it wasn't a good experience. But Dino De Laurentiis, who made Dune, turned around and gave him the opportunity to make Blue Velvet. And I think that set the tone for the rest of his career. And Blue Velvet, you know, like, I guess Dune was the first thing he did that starred Kyle MacLachlan, but then Blue Velvet kind of put Kyle MacLachlan in a meatier, juicier role. Dennis Hopper, Laura Dern, so many great actors that he worked with, and he got like the performances of their career. You know, we wouldn't know who Naomi Watts was, I don't think, without him. She was working a lot, but it was Mulholland Drive that really put her on most everybody's radar. What can you say about the guy? I don't think it's been since Robin Williams dying that I've been so bummed out by someone who I never met before dying.
Well, I remember when The Straight Story came out and
lost
your mind about how much you love The Straight Story. So
I love The Straight Story. I think I have it on DVD somewhere. Well, I mean, to me, like The Straight Story is the closest thing he ever tried to make to like a downright conventional film. It's G-rated. He made it for Disney. Yeah. And it stars Richard Farnsworth, I think, in his last role. It's really, I mean, like nobody took wilder swings than he did. And when you look at a movie like, like Lost Highway or Wild at Heart, you go like, you know, I saw these in movie theaters. These were playing on thousands of screens, and these movies are crazy. Like they are surrealism. And I like, you know, a friend of mine was complaining that we don't have who will be the next David Lynch. And I'm like, well, we still have Werner Herzog. We still have Jodorowsky. I mean, like there are still plenty. And then I think that it's impossible to see a movie like The Substance, which I won't shut up about this year, and not see the influence of David Lynch, or to see a movie like Titane. There are so many movies that I think derive from people like David Lynch, David Cronenberg, who's also kind of a contemporary of David Lynch, like people who are not afraid to bend cinema in ways that nobody else has ever done it. And I just you know I th I think his works are pretty amazing works of art, will be studied by scholars of film for years to come.
I think it's interesting that, look, obviously he's known for his artistic work. I seem to, when I, and I, in my mind, I don't know what your favorite David Lynch thing is of all time, but for me, it was season one of Twin Peaks. Season one of Twin Peaks, and he didn't do a ton of television, but that was like it redefined television, which was amazing. It had tons of mystery, and people still reference Log Lady and all kinds of the Black Lodge and all that stuff today. It's became part of the, culture,
No,
became part of the
season
culture
one
of
of Twin
this.
Peaks is just brilliant from start to finish.
And as I mentioned, or I alluded to, I was starting to allude to before, it's like he ended up doing a series of four commercials for a coffee brand in Japan, specifically that like kind of spoofs Twin Peaks. And it's done like kind of crazy and artsy. And you can find it all over the social media. It's out there.
Yeah, I would say my favorite thing of his of all time is definitely Blue Velvet. I rewatched it just a few years ago, and I mean, like, as an aficionado of horror movies, I would be hard pressed to come up with a scarier movie than Blue Velvet. And it's not just scary because of the circumstances in the movie, but I feel like it's a movie about how creepy the adult world is when you are young, you know, and how it just doesn't make any sense. And just I don't know. I mean, I could talk about Blue Velvet all night. I think it's one of the best made, most beautiful. I didn't understand it when I was a teenager. I remember seeing it and being annoyed by it and thinking it was pretentious. And then years later, watching it again, and it's not that it isn't pretentious, but it's so dark and creepy and then hilariously funny. And that's something that he would do all the time. And I probably few people would make this comparison, but we've had him on the show before. Don Coscarelli is a director who I think is able to mix, you know, for him, I think it's more horror tropes and humor and you know, like absurdism. And I feel like with David Lynch, it was more like noir mystery tropes with a healthy dose of the Wizard of Oz in everything, and then like just I don't know, like unironic humor that just hits you in an odd way. And when you see him interviewed, and there's tons of interviews of him on YouTube that you can find, I feel like you get that he was a guy who had a rich sense of humor, who knew exactly what he was doing, who had an amazing presence. And I remember hearing about a year ago that he had emphysema and was kind of not able to direct anymore. And I was super bummed out. I'm like, ah, he'll figure out how to do it. And then, you know, when I got the email, I think it was just a Variety email that said that he'd passed away. It was just like, ah, there goes my day. Like, what a terrible thing. What a huge loss to the art of filmmaking.
Yeah, he certainly is a singular vision. That's for sure. A lot of filmmakers owe him a debt. A lot of people were heavily influenced. So, we'll see. I don't know who the next David Lynch will be, but I don't know if it's someone. It's probably someone who's loves his work. So, yeah.
Or
Anyways.
who just loves weirdness and surreality and absurdity.
Yeah,
Who's the
that
next?
could.
I mean, like he was the next Louis Bunuel. I mean, you know, it's
Yeah, for sure. That's really accurate. Yeah. There's a little who was highly influenced by Salvador Dali. So, it's anyway, and you kind of feel like that thread going through anytime I think you see surrealism and surrealist in cinema.
But it's harder to pull off than you'd think, and he
Yeah.
did it. He did it with just amazing style and mastery. So, anyway, sorry to bring the room down, but I just felt like it was something we needed to talk about.
All right. Well, Ben, I think it's appropriate that we get to the interview with Rena Yang.
Here we go.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, and thank you for thank you for shooting The Fire Inside. It's great work. I want to start with the hackiest question I have, but I think it's important. You are DPing for Rachel Morrison on this movie, so you're the DP for an Oscar-nominated cinematographer who's outrageously accomplished, and her work is amazing. So what? So on The Fire Inside, was there any hesitation to work for someone who who does the same work as you, or did that make the job, you know, better, more interesting? Did, you know, like what was the relationship like with someone? You know, lots of directors don't shoot. Obviously, Rachel is like the quintessential shooter. She's amazing. So what was it like kind of working for not just a DP, but like a famous DP?
I actually didn't think too much about that, to be honest, because I tend to just go for things without overthinking if my instinct says that this is something you should do. And I mean, it did help that I've known Rachel for a while, just being in a female DPs in this the boys game. And we'd met before in real life, so it did help that I know what she's like, and you know. We like each other. We hang out. So that kind of, you know, whether we would get on a personal level kind of thing, I didn't really have any doubt that you know, it's gonna be okay. And I'm also used to shooting for, say, directors who are not full-time directors, say like the actors, musicians, or I'd also shot for Bradford Young, who's also a DP, and
Oh
he's
yeah.
directing
He's
commercials. So I'd had, you know, kind of experience working with someone who's not necessarily a director. Although Rachel is a director, she's been directing TV shows and commercials. And so, but I didn't think
by no
to.
means am I implying that she's not a director. I'm just saying that like I'm assuming, and maybe it's a
Oh,
big
yeah.
assumption, that like somebody like Rachel Morrison is gonna you know, you're gonna reach for the 65 millimeter lens and she'll be like, are you sure? And you know, like I just kind of wonder, I wonder how in the cinematography weeds does she get, or you know, actually it's interesting to hear about Bradford as well. We've had him on the show and he's amazing. I think his work is amazing and he's just a philosophical, amazing person. But
Agreed.
like you know, so when you're working for a DP, do you expect, and again, I'm not saying that these people aren't also directors, but when you're working for someone who's, you know, who's mainly known as a DP, is there any like what's the collaboration like, and is it different than when you're working with someone who isn't a DP?
I think I may communicate slightly differently in a way that I would just say the technical term straight up rather than say kind of expressing myself differently to a director who's not a cinematographer. You know, I wouldn't maybe say like, hey, like, okay, we're gonna go 48 frames, I'm gonna shoot 270 shutter. And then Rachel wouldn't ask me why I'm shooting a 270 shutter. You know, but then, you know, with other directors, I would explain like, is it all right if I shot 270 because I don't really like it when we ramp it back and then it looks like, you know, it's too choppy and that's not how I intended it to look if you ramp it back 24. You know, so it's kind of different. Or say if I'm talking to a director who's not like that into cinematography, then I'll just ask him about maybe like or suggest him about the feeling of the shot, like is it floaty or is it more like controlled. But whereas maybe if I speak to Rachel, like do you want Steadicam or Dolly? So like, we talked about like it was nice to have the shorthand, just skipping the tech chat, kind of getting to the point. That helped because we had a really insane schedule.
So, well, you say it's insane. So, like, when you say insane schedule, I know that it's all like it. I don't know where you shot everything, but it feels like you're all over the world.
I mean,
What kind of schedule was it?
well, we shot in Toronto, so we shot Toronto for Shanghai, London, and the interior locations, you know, Toronto for Flint. I mean, Rachel did do a little Flint uni at the end of the principal photography, but we were in Toronto all the time, and we had so many set builds and locations and multiple periods of time, you know, the past, present, and future kind of. So with, you know, the budget that was kind of budgeted pre-COVID and pre-inflation and,
Oh, man.
you know, all sorts of things. So, you know, making movie always is challenging in, you know, but this was, yeah, definitely challenging for sure.
Were you shooting during COVID?
No, it was after COVID because there was a first time around It was 2019. They tried to shoot, and then 2 days into production, got shut down. And then 2 years later, Rachel and Barry did a campaign to bring it back. And then Universal sold it to MGM, and then it came back around. I think 2 years later, then we finally managed to actually make the movie.
And you know, like the first thing that hit me watching the movie too is it's a period piece, but it's a very recent period. Like it's, and I often hear it said that it's like it's easier to make, you know, like 1850s London than it is to make something look like it was 15 years ago. And this is, I don't know if it was exactly 15 years ago, but it's thereabouts. Like and a lot of that's art department, costume, hair, stuff that's not your job. But like what, like when you're approaching kind of the period, because it starts like there's like a cold open almost when the main character is a child, and then we jump forward to when she's already kind of a phenomenal boxer, but she's still a teenager, so it's maybe a 10-year jump or so. What were your thoughts about like how to denote period in the way that you were filming?
Because I mean, authenticity was important for us because Clarissa Shields, she's still very much active. She's still boxing, and this is a biopic about her. And so we were kind of aware of, say, the kind of lights they have in Flint, or the say the 2012 Olympics in London. They used certain kind of broadcast cameras, and they had this very specific LED tunnel that we really tried hard to replicate. And so it's just very subtle kind of period accurate pieces and lighting peppered in, but because it's not like we're in the 80s or 50s, you don't really notice it unless you maybe think about like why we are using low-fi LEDs here and there.
And also, you know, given like you said, it's a biopic, and it's a biopic of someone who's, you know, both of the main characters, as far as I know, are still alive and active right now. So, and I guess, you know, I assume I don't know if the actors or the writers or whatever are talking to the real people. I assume they must be. But for you, did you go visit any of the real locations? Did you study the Olympics footage, any of that stuff to kind of really nail that look?
Yeah, I wish I had the chance to visit Flint, but because the pre-production was so fierce that we did talk about going to Flint, but then decided we had no time. I mean, Rachel's been there before, and so I heavily relied on the documentary T-Rex that the film was based on. And also the filmmakers of the documentary made a book. It's a really beautiful book on Flint and Clarissa, so I would kind of refer to that as my reference. And the Olympics, we did watch all the fights that she was in and what it was like, kind of the venue and then the coverage wise.
And like, you know, because there is a lot of boxing in this movie, because it's a boxing movie. Did you look at were there other boxing movies or other boxing footage, even, you know, live sports footage that you referenced to see like how did they do, how did they shoot it in, say, Ali or something, or Rocky, or any of the many Rockies? Like were you leaning into how it's been filmed before, or were you trying to come up with new ways to film it in a more interesting way?
I think neither, because I think I had seen those boxing movies as a child in Japan, I think, but not like with the filmmaker's eyes, but just as a child watching those movies. And I did kind of vaguely remember, and to me, it felt like that was enough because I didn't want to study them and say, like, copy the shots or be influenced by this visual noise that I didn't need in my head then. And I think in terms of the other we Rachel and I talked about how we wanted to shoot the boxing, but we decided that ultimately we just wanted to feel the fight from Clarissa's point of view rather than doing cool boxing shots. We did briefly talk about, like, do we bring in Phantom? Are we doing body rig here? And it just didn't feel right because even like our early draft of versions of the script, like, we had some surreal kind of dreamy sequences, but it as we started to prep the movie, it didn't quite feel right. So we took those out, as well as this kind of, say, it could be over-stylized boxing shots. So then it came down to very simple, just just kind of being with Clarissa in the ring kind of shot.
So what, so let's get a little technical, but like what, what was the approach? Like what lenses, what was the feeling you were trying to get across with the way that you were filming that kind of stuff? Filtration, anything that you were using to kind of get into the ring? 'Cause you're saying into the ring. So we're, because the story is so much about her and her mentor, and it's really a character piece in so many ways. It's a beautiful character piece about sort of a surrogate father-daughter relationship-ish. But like when we're in those rings, like that's it, like those fights are very, they're visceral.
Yeah, I think it is a beautiful two-hander, like a character story rather than, it's a boxing movie. It is a boxing movie, but boxing added on. So I think our hero lenses tended to be something like 27, 29 mil or 40, 50. And then we would rarely go longer than 50 mil. And for the dialogue scenes, same for the boxing matches. When we were in the ring, I think we were living on 27, 29 most of the time.
Oh, wow. So pretty wide.
And we might have gone to 40 when we had to sell the punches, and it just felt like we were too close.
What camera was it?
We used the Rialto.
What size sensor is that?
We ended up, so we had Venice too, but then we swapped out the sensor to the 6K because we didn't want 8K. This Sony does have this clinical look, and we just didn't want that much details. So we had the Venice 2 body, but the 6K sensor. So, the new camera, but then we put the old sensor in there, and we shot on the Panaspeeds.
And is that that's a full frame size sensor too?
6K, yeah.
Yeah, so when you're saying you're shooting on, what'd you say, a 20, 29 millimeter or whatever, 26, so that's even wider appearing on a sensor that size than if it was a Super 35 sensor.
Yeah, so I guess it feels like, I don't know, I can't do the math right now. Maybe it feels like 24 or something.
But it's like pretty wide without going fisheye or distorted.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I mean, we were, two 3.9 movie, so it's kind of cropped in. So maybe that didn't feel too warpy or that wide. But yeah, so that, and then we did use some long lens for maybe the Olympics where we were outside of the ring looking in. But those are the only times we would go long lens.
Let's talk a little bit about kind of the character stuff in the movie, because it's really touching and really sincere, and you have kind of a young actor in the lead. I don't know how old she is. I mean, she's probably, I don't know. I'm assuming she's over 18, so probably has, a decent amount of experience. But it's such a charactery film. And sometimes I wonder when I'm watching movies that are really character driven like this, that are kind of subtle. As a DP, did you find yourself like trying to create a world that they could move around in, or how locked down did you want them to be? Because it feels, and you could get the spontaneous feel either way, but it feels like such a real, believable, lived in world where they could do anything and go anywhere. What was that a consideration at all, I guess, is.
I think I lit the environment rather than say, like, here's the corner you can stand in, and then please don't move. So, Jason's house, I would light the whole house, and we'll see the blocking, and I'll bring in some specials that I could hide in a corner. But although it was set build, it was still quite tight with all the crew and the cameras and and the actors in there. So it was pretty much kind of, you go where you feel like it, and then I'd try and find you with the light if I need to. That was the approach.
Well, and so was it, I guess, was it like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, where you're kind of stacking up practicals and trying to light it as practically as possible? Or
yeah, I think for us the pracs were just accents in the background, so we would try to push the light through the windows, and as well as I had some soft boxes, like a little ceiling that I can pop out to add the ambient from the top. That was a get out of jail bill. And then I would have some eye light that I would float next to the camera if I really needed to have a little sparkles in their eyes. I was using Dash, the little, I'd call it mushroom light because it looks like mushroom.
Oh yeah, I know the ones you're talking about. On it. Those are really cool.
Yeah, so that was something we were using. But yeah, it was, yeah, in general, it's, you know, I wanted to let them have the freedom for sure, because it, you know, it is like naturalistic, and it's a naturalistic kind of movie. So it was important that they didn't feel like they had to hit the light or anything.
Yeah. So let's back out a little bit. I guess we sort of hit this at the beginning, but I'm just kind of curious. What brought you to the project, and, you know, like, what were your initial conversations with Rachel, like, you know, in terms of kind of establishing the mood, the tone, the look, you know, all of that stuff?
I knew that she was, you know, making this movie. Well, the first time around they were trying to make it in 2019, at that time I was shooting something else, and then when it came back around, she texted me about it.
So you were like already in her orbit as someone she wanted to bring on to this film back then, even.
Well, we joke about second choice because my friend Kay Arizmendi was going to shoot it before it got shut down. So they prepped and they shot 2 days and it got shut down. Then when it came back around, Kay was on something else. And this time I was available. And Rachel asked me if I wanted to shoot a movie, and I'd already watched the documentary because I was curious what they're making, and I loved the documentary. So when she asked me if I was interested, I was like, hell yes, you know, it's written by Barry Jenkins. I love his movies, and, you know, Rachel, I love you, you know, as a person and as a DP. And, you know, having watched the documentary, just Clarissa Shields is such a, you know, inspirational character, and the story had a lot of kind of many things that I could resonate with. You know, her being being a DP feels like an athlete. You know, so she's an athlete, and she comes from kind of underrepresented background, and, you know, she goes through the success and failure. That's, you know, that's relatable as anyone who wants to work in a creative industry or anything else. I guess just life. So I think you know, the Rachel, great story, great boxer, Barry Jenkins, and, you know, it was a no-brainer when they asked me to shoot it.
I've actually never seen that documentary. How much did it inform? Did any of that inform kind of the visual approach, or were you trying to set it apart from that?
Yeah, we did kind of talk about it in the beginning, because we were referencing the documentary a lot, but for us it was more to know where she came from and the community she grew up in.
Yeah,
and it wasn't a visual reference. But there was one scene that we really liked. It was Clarissa punching under the sodium light in the snow. That's something we took the inspiration from the documentary and put it into the movie. But the rest was pretty much kind of heightened narrative, you know, because we didn't want it to feel like documentary. We wanted it to feel like a movie.
Yeah. Can I be honest? I went and saw it at a screening months ago, and I didn't know till it was over that it was a true story. I doing the podcast, it's just like, hey, would you know, like, we know Rachel, we love Rachel's work.
Yeah.
And it was like, hey, Rachel has a new movie, will you go see it? I'm like, absolutely. But I hadn't looked into it. And then, like, at the very end, when they show the real Clarissa, I was like, oh my God, this all really happened? This is nuts. Yeah.
No, I'm glad that she's getting the recognition that she deserves. So what she's done is amazing, but just no one wanted to, you know, support her back then. Yeah.
So like I mean, I know that you were kind of saying that like just the compactedness of the production itself was a challenge. But you know, like were there any sequences that you found especially daunting, challenging, satisfying to pull off, or any specific shots? You know, I mean, it's so visual, but it's also just in this very lived in world. And so sometimes when you're watching something that's so convincing in that way, I don't see the hardship that went behind, you know, the bigger sequences for you.
Yeah, I guess all the boxing fights so much as daunting and satisfying at the same time. The anxiety of like, are we going to get the shots in the can without anyone getting injured, or that pressure? Because Ryan was in basically all the shots, and she had to throw the punches, and she had to be in there, and we had to make sure she doesn't get injured so we can do all the fighting scenes.
And she basically is trained almost as a stunt person at that point.
Yeah, I mean, she was an amazing boxer. I mean, she's it's astonishing how where she came from, and such an amazing boxer she became. So that was a huge challenge, and but then at the same time satisfying when we were able to shoot the scenes, and the fights looked amazing thanks to Ryan and the opponent, and also amazing camera operators who are in the ring with them.
Was it What kind of trickery did you use in there? Was it kind of the old school of just like putting the camera so that they could miss each other by, you know, 8 inches? And
Pretty much. We kept it very, very simple. It was just a Rialto handheld, or we used GG rig, which is like the hybrid of handheld and Steadicam, which I liked because Steadicam, it's just sometimes it's too slick, especially for boxing, and also not as reactive as I'd like it to be. But then handheld would be too shaky for some shots, so we would use GG, which does have some sort of stabilization, but still has the kind of little roughness to it. So
I'm not familiar with what that is. Is that like a gimbal or something?
It looks like, I mean, attaches to the Steadicam arm on the vest, but it has this kind of gimbal, that kind of is a little floaty. So yeah, luckily we had a great operator. Oh, we had a that was another challenge, that we had so many operators, because so we originally had Mike Heathcote, who did all the Creed, and he's done boxing movies, and he was prepping with us. He would attend the choreography session with us, and we would design the shots with him. But then a week before the shoot, he tore his abdomen, and he had to rest, of course.
Oh no.
But it was so busy in Toronto that we had n no consistent camera operators, for a camera. So we would have like a week of this person, and the
Oh
2 weeks
wow.
of this person. So that's kind of the reason why me and Rachel ended up operating some of the scenes, because we had more time to prep when we knew the actors and the story, but then not necessarily the operator who
I was
got
curious if you'd
flown
done
in a few days
I was curious
before.
if you'd done any of the operating. And I mean, you know, again, it's not out of the realm of possibility a lot of directors will operate, but I was wondering if Rachel ever wanted to get in there and,
I mean, she did ask in prep. That was something, and I was like, I'm fine, as long as the director's a good operator, I don't mind. And
Does she have the qualifications?
she does. And I mean, the relationship we had, I was really honest. She would ask if she did a good job, and then I'd be like, that was good. Or then she would, do this other scene, and then I'd be like, I think that was good, but I think she does something that's less like active and a little bit more quiet with the camera. Or but we can be very honest with each other.
I would personally be terrified to give Rachel Morrison camera operator notes.
Well, no, I think it was just so she had the kind of options in the edit, and so I think that was just like a testament that we had a really great collaboration, like relationship. I was just really honest about, like, oh, because she if she's operating, and she'd ask if we got the performance, and then did you feel it, and then be like, yeah, we felt that, we got it, let's move on, kind of, so that
That's
was,
awesome.
yeah, So that was great.
I mean, like, what percentage of the movie do you think you operated?
Well, very little, because again, we had for boxing matches, I was looking at like six cameras, and then but I was mixing lights live myself
Oh my God,
rather than
really?
and talking to the operators at the same time. Like, don't go there, you're gonna cast a camera
okay.
shadow.
So I have a question that torments me that I want to know. Okay,
yeah.
So you're looking at six monitors. How do you keep your eyes on six monitors? How are you able to do it? Like, to me,
yeah.
that is
yeah.
something that, like, the people who do it blow my mind.
Oh, I mean, I'm kind of used to it because I tend, not six cameras, but, you know, I'm used to, like, talking to two cameras from the DP station. But when I say six cameras, say the three are broadcast cameras, and then the other three, you know, we brief each operator. So, like, you know, your task is to, you're going to be in the ring with her, or, like, you're going to be by the side from through the rope. Then this camera is going to be maybe up in the arena from, you know, bird's eye view. So
yeah,
I mean, it's not like it's, I think it's more you get nice surprises rather than trying to micromanage them. I think as long as you brief them what you're looking for, then let them find good shots, and that's kind of how I roll. and then live talk, because not necessarily, you know, they can't see each other. So I'll be like, okay, like B's coming into A, just, you know, step back a bit, that kind of stuff. Or like, you guys got the same shots. Can you, you know, A go here or B look
yeah,
that
yeah.
way? So, yeah.
And like, how did you and Rachel kind of prep for like the coverage you were going to get in that scene? Were there storyboards, overhead diagrams, shot lists? Like what's your favorite method to kind of get these world-class visuals?
Yeah, every single movie or any projects I do, I shot list, you know, from the beginning to the end very meticulously. And I have like the spreadsheet to see how it flows from scene to scene. So that we did that also for the Fire Inside. We had a spreadsheet of the detailed shot list, you know, are we using Steadicam camera or what are we looking for with this shot? And so each scene we had, we broke it down into shots. So we knew what needed to get to make the scene. But then on the day we would block and then adjust and adapt the shots or combine all our shots. So that was our approach. But we didn't do any storyboard. It didn't really make sense because it's not like we had huge VFX sequences that we needed to, you know, communicate with different departments. And also, you know, Rachel doesn't like to do storyboard, and I see why. You know, it's just become such a, like, a rigid reference. And so yeah, we didn't do storyboard for this shot. But I mean, I had floor plan, but that was more for me for lighting. So yeah, it was. I mean, we had a little toy with a boxing ring with two little wrestlers.
That's cool.
Like when you plan the car chase shots with the toy cars, you know.
Oh yeah.
We had the toy wrestlers.
Like Rock'em Sock'em Robots or something.
Yeah. So it's like, okay, so she goes here, and then we're here, and then
but that's very helpful. I mean, then you kind of walk in with a strong idea of the choreography.
Yeah, but the best was just basically get in the ring and then block it with iPhone, block it with phone, and record it on the video.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and see how that sells.
Like during a rehearsal, I assume. So like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. If the punches look right.
Is there some story, some anecdote from the shooting in the movie that we haven't covered that you think is a really cool story that, you know, aspiring cinematographers or fellow cinematographers would find interesting?
I think if you watch it, it may look like a quite simple movie, although it was logistically very challenging. But we shot the movie in the summer and the movie starts in the winter. And so anyone who shot summer for winter, it's nightmare and it's very challenging because we had, you know, a very hot Toronto summer sun blasting outside and we had to make it look like winter.
Winter in Flint, which is, you know,
different
than winter in LA.
Yeah, so there was a lot of blue screens and trying to diffuse the light and a lot of effort went into trying to make it look like winter. And I also the main location, the gym, because it was practical location, and again because it was summer for winter, Our first week of the shoot, we have to shoot nighttime, I mean night for night. And we have those the two little kids, Clarice and Zay, when they're, was it 12? Yeah, when they were kids. And because it was night shoot, it was 3 or 4 a.m. with kids trying
Oof.
to box, trying to keep them awake.
Well, I bet
That
they were
was
punchy.
Very challenging, because anyone would feel sleepy at 3 a.m. but kids and trying to box, that was definitely a challenging moment. And when we finished shooting that location, we were very glad
Was that
we
Jim?
survived.
Was that Jim the Oh wait, you didn't shoot that in Flint. So that Jim, was that the real one or no?
It was a set build, but on location.
Okay. Well, why'd you have to do it? Why'd you have to shoot at night if it was a set?
Well, because it's supposed to be was it oh it was just we had too many windows to tent, and the tent would have been
Oh
humongous.
man.
We couldn't afford it,
Oh
like
man.
100 foot tent outside wouldn't have been enough, because I needed the light and the distance and height. And just we were
Oh
like,
man.
okay, we need to shoot night for night. We just gotta bite the bullet and try and keep the kids awake.
Hard enough to work with kids during the day, man. At
I
night is.
know. Yeah, and it's first week, so that was challenging.
Cool. Well, I'd just like to ask you some questions about, sort of your career leading up to this. And I always like to ask people, like, what was the moment in your life where you realized being a cinematographer was like a job you could pursue? And like, when did it occur to you that that's what you were going to pursue?
So I completely fell into this. It's not like I grew up dreaming to become a DOP as a child. All I wanted was just move out of Japan somewhere where I can feel like myself. I mean, Japan here is amazing, but if you're a little bit different, you feel like, you feel very suffocated there. I mean, going back now is a bit more fun, but growing up, I wanted to go abroad, kind of leave Japan. That was the initial dream. Then I moved to London when I was 21, after saving up money for like, I don't know, 10 years. And then I lived there. When I moved there, I didn't speak English, so I studied English for like a year. Then, because I loved living in London so much, I was like, okay, I need to stay here. But okay, in order to stay here, I need to get a visa. And then I heard about this the degree, the BA degree, that if I had this degree and study for 2 to 4 years, I can get work permit after. So it was very like logistical calculations, like, okay, I go to school for another 2 years, I get this degree, then I get this degree, then I get a work permit, and I can stay in London for 5 years. Great, this is my life plan for the next 5 years. Then I was like, okay, what should I study? And I looked at, like, I was, was into like photography, art, and I would make my own stop motion animations and edit stuff. And I did love watching movies. So I looked at, say, learning fine art and modern art, but I didn't really get the course description didn't really make sense to me. I'm like, I'm not sure about this modern art course. And also, it would take me 4 years to get a degree, so that wasn't really, part of my
Well,
plan.
it's not like cinematography is like a lock and load career, but modern art is maybe even a tougher line to walk.
So I ended up in a film school because I saw this ad on the bus one day saying that you can get a BA in 2 years. I was like, oh, brilliant, that's perfect, I love watching movies, let's go to film school. Then I got in, and the only thing I knew about filmmaking then was that there's a director, full stop. So I didn't know anything about filmmaking. Like, if the teachers asked what you guys wanted, what do you want to become, everyone would say, I want to become a director. So I thought, I guess that's how you make movies, that you're a director and then you make movies. But then transpires, it's not the way, and there are many different roles. So I started film school. I thought I'd become an editor because I liked editing. I guess because I could manipulate the shots. But then at some point, I didn't like the shots I was getting, and I didn't understand. I was like, why is this show? I can't use this. Or, why won't they just go here and shoot it like this? And
Is that
then,
like, real quick, like chronologically, are we after you're out of school, were you working as an
no, I'm
editor?
still a a school because we had to
Yeah.
kind of pick what we wanted to pursue. And I thought I wanted to become an editor. But then I realized that that's not what I wanted because, and also I was working as a runners on short films or small projects on weekends and during the holiday. And one day I saw this woman working as a DP, and I didn't know what it was, but because I'd never seen it before, I've only seen boys in the camera department and had to just double take. I was like, what is that? Like, what is she doing? And then someone told me that she's a DP. I was like, what? Like, what? She could be DP because I thought I had to just do all these things. The girls are doing it. And then
Oh, really?
it was like eye-opening experience for me that I'm like, wow. And then
Do you
I
remember who she was?
oh so her name is Sarah Dean. She's a British DP. So that was like an eye-opening experience. And I was like, I want to do what she's doing. That's what I've been wanting to do because I always like touching cameras and doing like a filming things myself. So I decided that I want to do what she's doing. But literally, there's no female DPs back then, let alone some Asian woman trying to be a DP. So I started shooting like indie short films and make a lot of indie music videos with my friends. And then,
Is this still in school or are you out of school
oh,
now?
this is out of school now, making short films and music videos. I did work as a clapper loader on bigger projects to support myself while I was shooting smaller projects for the DP. And yeah, I was shooting so many music videos, and then the big labels started to ask, they started asking me to shoot the music videos, the signed. Big artists, and then that's
Yeah,
kind
you have a ton of music videos on your
of
reel, yeah.
yeah, so that's how it's
And it's interesting because it's like a time period, like I think of the golden age of music videos starting in the early to mid 80s and kind of petering out in the early 2000s, but a lot you have a lot of stuff since the in the in the last over the last 15, 20 years, tons of music videos. And to me it's like it's great to see it. But you know, like I the music video world might as well be on another planet as far as I'm concerned. Like I don't quite understand where the music video because like the middle class fell out of music videos, so it just became like crazy low budget music videos or like again, this is from the outside looking in from where you are, you know, bigger budget music videos with major artists.
Yeah, I mean, music video is such a great place to, train.
Yeah.
It was a really good boot camp for me that you have very little money, but you have to make it look highly visual. Every single shot needed to be maybe like eye candy or, it look amazing. But then you have to run around and do things yourself
Yeah.
because you have a lot less resources.
Even on those, because again, it, you know, again, from the outside looking
Oh,
in, it,
that was me coming up. But now that if I do a bigger video, so it's not so much like I'm running around doing my
yeah.
own thing. But still, the pressure of kind of striking visual is very high. Because it's all about the visuals and the song rather than say there's a dialogue. So that was a great training ground, shooting music videos and then transitioning to commercials. And then at some point, my agent told me you should start shooting narrative. I'm like, okay, well, I've done actually loads of short films at the same as well as music videos. It's just I got busy in music videos and commercials, and I didn't have time to do so many short films, but I'd
Man,
moved
you got
into
to ride that out when you get on a wave like that.
So I started to yeah so I started shooting TV shows, did a bit of that, and then then recently I started shooting movies.
Well, you're off to an amazing start, you know. I think this movie's definitely I don't know. I again, not sitting in your shoes, like I would imagine your phone would be ringing off the hook right now that you know people would be wanting you to shoot their stuff because it's such great work. And you know, the Oscar season's just kind of starting to get going, but I'm assuming it's going to be at least in the mix.
Well, who knows? It's very
is
saturated there, so.
It's saturated and it's also political as all hell. And I was talking to a friend of mine who's a makeup effects guy, and he was talking about how political the makeup effects world is in terms of just getting in the Oscar races and union awards and stuff like that. But I mean, like, you know, this is I think it's a pretty substantial, awesome film, and I think you know, people are going to be really moved by it.
Yeah, well, I'm happy if people watch the movie, and then, you know, the award and everything is the cherries on top. I mean, for me, maybe not for everyone. But,
well, yeah.
It'd be great. Yeah.
Well, and hopefully, if nothing else, we'll just get to see more of your work in the next few years.
Yes.
You know, on stuff of the size and bigger. Well, cool. Well, thank you so much for your time. Before we go, is there a Instagram, website, any place that you interact with people who might have questions or, you know, just want to see more of your work?
Yeah, I've consolidated to just Instagram. I have deleted Twitter and Facebook long time ago, and
good for you.
And LinkedIn for anyone in the UK, maybe they know.
We're on LinkedIn over here.
Okay, so I don't have anything but Instagram. So if you want to reach out, yeah, it's my name. Hopefully, you can find me there.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, and we look forward to seeing. I hope that this movie has serious legs as we move into the season, but also can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you so much. Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. So that was Rena Yang. Rena, thank you so much for coming on the show. Great work. I hope people go out to the theater and check out The Fire Inside if they have it playing near them, and if not, I'm sure it will be streaming momentarily. Ilya, I believe you told me something about it being time to pay some bills or something.
It's true. We have to thank our fine friends over at VenusOptics/Laowa. Their website is Laowa Cine. If you'd like to take a look at what they've got going on, they have a ton of cinema lenses, including the Laowa 24mm T8 2x macro ProTube. And that just kind of rolls off the tongue there. I know it's a long name, but what it is a probe lens, and they spell it with
when
a
you said
number.
T8, I was like, that better be a probe lens.
Yeah, they spell it with a number in the middle of the word. So it's Pro2B or ProTube, as I think they actually would like everyone to pronounce it. And it's an incredible set of three probe lenses. They are waterproof and I mean, or to a certain distance, I want to say like 36 centimeters or something like that. So plenty enough to go into like fish tanks and things like that. They also have interchangeable mounts. So for pretty much any camera system out there, they come in PL, but you can also get EF, RF, Z, E, and of course, Leica L, which is very popular for multiple camera systems out there that have all adopted the L mount. They're pretty affordable and very high quality. $2,800 for one, and then they have a three-lens kit, which I want to say is $8,500.
Oh, nice. So,
and this three-lens kit actually offers quite a bit of versatility, bent angles, different sorts of trickery, and T8 for a probe lens is actually relatively fast, especially considering that just a few years ago, the only sort of budget-priced probe lens out there was a T14. So
I was
really
about to say, I seem to recall that the Fraser lens was like a T20 or something ridiculous.
Yeah, I think it also was an 8, but you didn't really want to use it at less than a 14. You really did want to have it like stop down. You really wanted to get a lot, or at least, you know, 11-16 split, which is really what the 14 is, so. Anyway.
But yeah, you're not going to be shooting an interview on a probe lens. You're probably going to be shooting outdoor nature stuff or something, you know, where you can get a lot of light.
Yeah.
Tabletop.
Anyway, I've messed around with the ProTube lenses, and they're incredible. The three lens kit comes with a very nice case. Native PL mounts, as I said before, but definitely worth checking out. Of course, you can check them out at Hot Rod Cameras. Hot Rod Cameras keeps demos of these lenses, so you should come on down if you're in LA and check them out. Otherwise, reach out to us because there might be something we can do for you remotely if you'd like to see them. They're worth seeing. They're pretty impressive.
I'd like
especially
to.
Especially for tabletop, any sort of miniature, anything like that. Stop
tabletop,
motion,
it's
all
the best,
of these things are.
And now, short ends.
So Ben, it is our short end time. It's the time we talk about our pet obsession of the week. What are you all about? What is your obsession?
The band OK Go. Anybody remember OK Go?
Oh, I know what it's going to be then because I just watched this. So yeah. Go for it.
OK Go is a band that I was actually a fan of OK Go's before they got I won't say gimmicky, but they became kind of gimmicky with the videos, and they did that one video that's them on treadmills kind of in the early days of YouTube. It went ultra viral, and because it's like a really clever use of them on treadmills, and then every one of their videos became kind of like a weird exploration of it's hard to explain, but like the concept of how the images themselves were made. Probably my favorite one was the one that they did on the Vomit Comet, where they were in zero gravity for real. And the thing about their videos is they don't use trickery. They do it all for real. They did in one camera. Where it was like, they did one once where it was like them pixelated in, I think it's Echo Park. And it literally took like 3 days to film the whole thing. And they choreograph these things precisely and figure it, come up with a concept, and they work that concept to death. And, you know, they did one that was like an amazing Rube Goldberg machine. You know, they did one where they had like, I forget, it was like, you know, 500 printers that were printing out backgrounds for them, and they were flying around in front of them and stuff. Like, their videos are great. And if you're into, I don't even know what you would call it, it's just kind of like video art almost, definitely check out their videos. And I think this video, they dropped a video literally yesterday as I'm talking, for a song called A Stone Only Rolls Downhill. And they shot it on 64 iPhones. And so basically they made 64 iPhones with 64 pieces of video that they would play on the iPhones, and they would, and they played within the video. And it's all incredibly brilliantly synchronized and gorgeous and weird and artistic. And it's just engrossing. And you look at it, of course, and like, you know, the first thought I have is like, well, you know, any doofus with After Effects could make this happen. But it's like, that's not how they did it. They did it. They do it for real. They made like 64 videos on 64 iPhones and figured out how to make them all synchronize.
Wow.
And it's gorgeous. There's, if you watch it, there's actually a behind the scenes that it links to immediately afterwards. But like all their, they do behind the scenes on a lot of their videos. And, it was just like another home run for them. Like I feel like, and my son has seen all of their videos 1,000 times. It's stuff like it's kid friendly, but moreover, I just think like if you're into kind of just a brilliant use of the form, you know, it's completely worth watching their stuff. And they're also you know, great musicians, so that doesn't hurt.
I agree. And, you know, let me tell you, for my money, their video for kneading/getting is my absolute favorite. And I would actually recommend that as the entryway to anyone who, you know, maybe their original sort of music video that on the treadmills is.
Yeah, Here It Goes Again, I think is that song.
But I would say kneading/getting to me is the most incredible. I think they shot it 3 times to make that work. And I think that the final video, there's like 3 different ones cut together. But essentially, they took a car and they drove it through a track, and where the car becomes an instrument.
I've seen it many times. Yeah, it's good.
It's 1.2 million views or so on YouTube now. I highly, highly recommend it.
Well,
so.
I would check out I Won't Let You Down, too, which is one of that's... just
the an outrageous, the
it's a drone shot, but it's also just an outrageous piece of mass choreography, hundreds of people.
Yes. And, it was shot in Japan, where, they got special permission because they go way above the 400-foot like ceiling that drones are usually not allowed to fly beyond. So that's, they did some cool stuff in that.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's mine. So Ilya, what is your pet obsession this week?
Well, I was almost alluding to it because, drones in this country have a series of regulations, and the number one drone manufacturer is a company called DJI. They're based out of China. For a while, it looked like they were going to get banned from selling drones in this country. That seems to have now gone away. And what did DJI do in response to that? They eliminated the geofencing that allows people to fly in previously restricted zones, including unlawfully. So there are zones currently that the DJI software, if you buy this drone, will not let you fly. It won't let you take off in these areas. And if you approach those areas, it's like a hard stop. You can't go into these areas. Sometimes you can get into them depending on where you're at. But for the most part, no, they really block it off. That's changed with this latest update, and they now just give you a stern warning. And they gave some sort of lip service as to like, oh, it's always kind of been this way, and we're just really all our
go ahead, fly it right into the airport. I mean, like, really?
Well, this is like, of course, was very prescient this past week when someone's drone damaged one of the big water scoopers that was putting out fires in Los Angeles. So,
Oh, no.
yeah, it was really terrible. And there's photos of it online of the damaged wing and the drone that was recovered. So it's like, yeah, there are there's some warnings that anyone who's flying a drone should be paying attention to. And in fact, anyone who's got the 107 license that's required to operate a drone commercially really ought to be aware of, because there could be some real serious penalties if you violate that sort of thing. If you're a consumer, there's also penalties, but really, I think that the professionals, who they're only people who could ever be anywhere near some of these zones after getting special permits and doing other things, really, it's going to be interesting to see what happens. I don't think that people will be bad actors, but there were bad actors during the fires, so you never know. Human nature being
I don't
what
know.
it
I
is,
was about to say, you've met people, right?
Yes, I
Like,
know. I've met people,
some
and
of them are
I.
outrageous douche canoes. I
Oh,
and
yeah.
some douche canoes buy drones.
That's true,
Most
and
drone
it's
people are, I mean,
are
like,
great.
yeah.
Yeah, it's a small number of people who will ruin it for everybody else, is really what it is. And I'd say that's just about life. That's really life. Small numbers of people ruining things
Correct.
is really kind of how it goes. Oh, well, anyway, Ben, I think that just about does it for this episode.
Oh boy.
So, where can people find you if they want to track you down?
You can track me down at benrock.com. Go to benrock.com and check out my reel and whatever. Find me on social media. I'm on Blue Sky. I'm certainly weaning myself off of Twitter. I feel like I maybe am officially at the point of not wanting to dip my toe in that toxic swill ever again. But I'm at Blue Sky at Neptune Salad. Feel free to follow me, say hello, LinkedIn, et cetera, et cetera. How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
Find me over at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com, and this week in New York. So, but I don't know when this episode drops, so it might be too
In New
late for the
York,
people in New
so
York. Yeah.
they can track you down that far.
They can track me down. I'm not too hard. If they hit me up on social media, I'll probably be like, "Hey, I'm in New York and I'm doing an event this week." And yes, it'll be a thing. So, anyway, Ben, I think that just about does it. Do you want to take us out?
Oh, we didn't thank anybody.
Ah, shit, we didn't thank people. Let's thank some people right now. Okay. So, Ben, who do we have to thank? Who made this show possible?
Well, first and foremost, our amazing producer, Alana Cody, who's gotten us so many great interviews, and we have some great ones coming up as well, as always. I think I say that every time, but it's true. Thanks to Alana, I've gotten to speak directly to several of my heroes. So I have her to thank for that. We got to thank Michael. Indispensable Dispenza, who edited this, hopefully making us not sound like complete doofuses, but it's on me if I sound like a doofus. I'm okay with that. And also, lastly but never least, we got to thank Kazal Attrakshi, who composed every scrap of music you hear on this podcast. Check out his work at www.musicbykaze.com. That's KAYS. Hire him to score something for you, or color correct your next thing, or direct it, or do visual effects. And I'm not even exaggerating when I tell you he's excellent at all of those.
Yes, he's quite the multi-hyphenate talented individual. So, Ben, now that we've thanked all those people, do you want to take us out?
Not especially, but I'll do it anyway. Thanks for tuning in.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.